From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, what parents should know about the uptick in eating disorders during the pandemic.
There are warning signs around a child's behavior with food.
And then, the latest campaign finance disclosure reveals one state rep's eyebrow-raising expenses.
He stated that sometimes you have to meet people where they're at. That was his response when we asked him about the $221 he had spent at a strip club in Dearborn.
Plus, a critical look at the FBI's use of confidential informants investigating the plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
There are people who perceive this case as the government, averting a terrible plot and keeping, the world and the country safe from domestic extremism. And then there are people who perceive this case as like an absolute witch hunt.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, two reporters from BuzzFeed talked to us about how the FBI investigated the plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer and the role that confidential informants ended up playing in the case.
There are people who perceive this case as the government, averting a terrible plot and keeping, the world and the country safe from domestic extremism. And then there are people who perceive this case as like an absolute witch hunt.
That story's coming up later in the hour, but first, we wanted to find out more about a public health crisis that may have been a byproduct of the pandemic lockdown. Over the past year, multiple children's hospitals say that they have seen a surge in eating disorder admissions. Providers say that the pandemic triggered an overwhelming demand for eating disorder treatment, and many of the parents involved feel desperate. They know their kid is sick, but they're struggling to get help. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports on what advice experts and parents who've been through this have for families.
Amelia Haywood's story is the kind that doctors say they have been hearing over and over again for months now.
So my name is Amelia. I'm 15 years old. I play volleyball, and about 6 months ago, I was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa.
Amelia has long brown hair. She wears it loose over her red athletic jacket. And she's sitting in her home in suburban Grand Rapids. To understand how she got better, first you have to understand how she got sick. It started when the pandemic hit last March, because suddenly this busy, talkative, high-achieving kid felt completely lost.
People are dying. Everyone's getting sick. You can't see your friends. It was hard because I felt like I didn't have any control over anything except what I ate and how I exercised.
So she was like, I'm going to eat healthy. I'm just going to stay in good shape. But then as quarantine stretched into summer and then into fall and then into winter, that intensity and that restriction started to consume her. She would make these elaborate smoothie bowls and then post pictures of them to Instagram. But she'd give the smoothie to her sister and lie and say she'd already eaten. She would skip time with friends to be able to go for runs, and she would wear baggy sweatpants to cover up her weight loss. Even after she was diagnosed with anorexia, the disease took such a toll that she landed in the emergency room 4 times and was hospitalized 3 times.
These are kids whose bodies are failing because of their poor nutritional intake.
This is Dr. Terry Bravender. He is an adolescent medicine doctor, and he specializes in eating disorders at the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. It's one of the places where Amelia was treated.
The medical hospital is really a safety net rescued for them so that they don't starve to death.
During the first year of the pandemic, the number of eating disorder hospitalizations at Mott Children's doubled. Boston Children's Hospital just published a study of their own saying that they've been seeing a surge too. And some experts think that the pandemic acted as kind of like a mass trigger for kids and teens who were already genetically vulnerable to eating disorders. Even before the pandemic, though, there was already a shortage of programs and therapists who know how to treat these illnesses. Doctors say they are now hearing from parents who are calling as many as 60 therapists and cannot get their kid in anywhere. Amelia's mom, Jennifer Ackerman Haywood, says navigating her daughter's illness felt like being in a maze.
It seems insane because if your child gets a cancer diagnosis or something else, there's a protocol for cancer. There's a protocol for some of these other illnesses out there. There isn't a universal protocol for eating disorders.
So Jennifer did what so many others have done. She talked to other parents and as many experts as she could possibly find. Here's some of what she learned. First, if you think your kid may be at risk for an eating disorder, you need to take them to the doctor immediately. Even your primary care physician can get you a diagnosis and make referrals. And also make sure you get your kid's test results right away, not just for weight, but for things like blood pressure and heart rate. Jennifer says it was weeks before they learned that Amelia had fallen off the growth chart and that her EKG showed a dangerously low heart rate.
When I learned about what her rate was 3 weeks prior, I realized that she was about a point away from like a immediate medical, like she'd have to be immediately hospitalized. And I just thought, wow, we were that close to that and we didn't know.
Number two. Find a psychotherapist who specializes in eating disorders. You can go to the National Eating Disorder Association's website. They've got a list of providers based on where you live, as well as a lot of other really useful tools. And even if there aren't any qualified specialists nearby, a lot of providers are now doing virtual visits. Number three, understand that before your kid can get better mentally, they need to get better physically, often through a strategic nutrition plan. When Jennifer first put her daughter into therapy, she didn't factor in how malnourished Amelia was.
What I didn't realize at the time, that now I fully understand, is that when your child is medically unstable, they cannot process therapy sessions and things like that. If your brain is starved and your heart is suffering and your organs are being robbed of nutrition, like you can't mentally do that work yet.
And finally, number four, don't give up. Recovery is possible, but setbacks do happen. So don't be afraid to get more intensive treatment if your child isn't improving. Jennifer says that checking her daughter into an inpatient treatment center was one of the hardest things she has ever had to do. But for Amelia, it ended up being a turning point.
Being able to talk to people who are going through the same thing helped me so much and realize that I'm not alone.
These days, Amelia's recovery is really going well. Jennifer says it feels like they are not out of the woods yet, but they can at least see the path. And Amelia, for her part, really wants others who are going through this to know that it does get better.
And now I'm starting to get activity back. I can hang out with my friends and live my life how I want to live. And I know it's really hard to recover, and I know it's really hard to just like reach out, but at the end of the day, it's so worth it.
Adolescents with eating disorders and their families can feel completely alone in this, but they don't have to be. We're also putting a bunch more resources online at michiganradio.org that you can check out.
We invited Kate Wells here to dive a little deeper on some of the warning signs about eating disorders and how parents and families and their kids can better understand why we're seeing more of this now and how to help. Hey, Kate, thanks for coming.
Hey, April. Thanks for doing this kind of extra time on this. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Obviously, a lot of kids struggled with mental health issues during the pandemic. And, you know, I've just got to believe as a parent, it's got to be hard to know how to help. You don't want to say the wrong thing. Everybody's been under a ton of stress. And the last thing you'd want to do is create more issues, right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody is kind of in this boat. Everybody who heard about this reporting was like, oh, I'm glad you're doing this because here's what's going on with my kid. And I don't know whether I should say something. So just know right now that your family is not alone in this. Your kid is not alone in this. Every single body and mind that made it through the pandemic, including your own kids, made it through an enormous amount. And that stress has taken a toll on a lot of folks.
Yeah, for sure. I have this feeling that diets also went through radical rethinking during the pandemic. You know, a lot of people were just home and eating in different ways than they had usually eaten. I assume that just eating different things and interacting differently is not necessarily a warning sign. I mean, what should parents be looking for in their kid that might be of concern?
So there's a couple of things. One, so yes, weight loss, weight gain, or frequent weight fluctuations, but put a pin in that. Failure to gain weight as expected, like if they drop off their growth chart at the doctor's office, an inability or a lack of desire to eat a variety of foods without experiencing like a lot of anxiety or discomfort or guilt
if they eat different foods than the rest of their family, if they're skipping meals or snacks, if they're cutting entire food groups or types of food out of their diet, if you feel like they're exercising kind of compulsively, or if you notice that food is going missing, that can sometimes be a sign of binge eating. And generally, too, just social withdrawal, low mood, irritability, anxiety, all these symptoms can be caused by malnutrition. But of course, you also see that in just what it's like to kind of be a teenager or a kid right now.
Yeah. Do you think that there's anything that we can be aware of in terms of what kids observe from us? I mean, some people put on weight during the pandemic. Some people took the time and, you know, kind of got their habits in order and developed some healthy new ones. Did you hear from the experts that kids are watching as we track our calories?
Yes. So in the way that we talk to kids about food and in the way that we think about eating disorders, we know that two things are happening here. One, they're genetic. So a family doesn't cause an eating disorder any more than a kid causes an eating disorder. There is a genetic predisposition to this disease. The other factor is the environment. And as we just heard, obviously the pandemic was an environment that triggered this. But the experts say that even more than worrying about your kid's weight is to look at the environment as a whole that they're in. You know, we've all been thrown off in this last year. So if you're worried because, like, oh, you started doing a lot more screen time during the pandemic, or like in my house, like the dining room that we used to have family meals at has been turned into my office. Are you starting to slowly get back when you can to having the kinds of options and opportunities for kids in terms of activities and a wide range of food? And you talked about, are they watching us? Yes. Our kids don't miss a beat. And if something that you're wrestling with in your own life around food, they can pick up on that. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect, but it means that talking to them honestly about it and keeping that focus on a wide balance rather than good foods or good weight or a bad weight is what they need to be healthy.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Kate, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you, April.
Coming up, we're going to unpack the state's most recent campaign finance reports and some of their eye-popping findings.
I wish that I could tell you that spending exorbitant amounts of money eating at very lavish restaurants is something that's uncommon or outside the norm in Michigan. But unfortunately, this is behavior that we see come up pretty regularly.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. While we are more than 1 year out from Michigan's next major election, gears are grinding behind the scenes, and fundraising is well underway for legislative contests and the governor's race. Not many people in this world get hot and bothered about campaign finance reports, but we have been fortunate enough to find two of them to help us unpack everything that they learned yesterday as filings were entered into Michigan's public reporting system. Craig Mauger is a reporter for the Detroit News and former director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. And Simon Schuster is the current director of Michigan's Campaign Finance Network. It's a nonpartisan nonprofit that does deep reporting into political spending in the state. Simon, Craig, good to talk to you. Thanks for coming.
Great to be here, April. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There were a few doozies that I know you both had your eye on from the campaign spending reports that were filed and reported out yesterday. Let's start out with the one that seems to have gotten the most headlines. State Representative Jewel Jones, a younger Democrat who represents a district in Inkster, spent campaign money on an expensive dinner in Las Vegas as well as at a strip club in Detroit. I mean, it is what it is. Craig, what did he say anything to you about these expenditures?
Yes, he actually exchanged some messages with my colleague Beth LeBlanc, who's another political reporter here at the News, and he stated that sometimes you have to meet people where they're at. That was his response when we asked him about the $221 he had spent at a strip club in Dearborn. As far as the Las Vegas spending, a $700 bill at a restaurant there, it's unclear to us at this moment what exactly happened with that. But the state representative from Inkster spent a lot of money on food over the first 7 months of the year, we can tell from his disclosure.
Jewel Jones was in the news last year, too, for being arrested while driving super drunk, and more recently for violating the terms of his probation. We should clarify that these campaign expenditures may be notable. You know, they may get our attention. But, Simon, they're not illegal, are they?
No, that's correct. I wish that I could tell you that spending exorbitant amounts of money eating at very lavish restaurants is something that's uncommon or outside the norm in Michigan. But unfortunately, this is behavior that we see come up pretty regularly. That's not to say that all candidates engage in this kind of spending, but it's what we find is that there is a number of candidates who and elected officials who will sort of take spending up to the limit or the bounds allowable under law. And time again, we see that they have really broad latitude to spend money on things that they can then qualify as business expenses.
Yeah. Elsewhere, Governor Gretchen Whitmer's war chest is in overdrive, according to these reports. She has raised $8 million this period, if I'm reading this right. And her committee's bank balance now stands at around $10 million. We should also mention that she has few Republican challengers as of this moment. And I believe no one anywhere near her fundraising game, right? Right, Simon?
That's correct. This is money that this is an unprecedented amount of money to see raised in a period this far from the election. And there's really nothing to compare it against just because of how far and away large it is. But of course, it's not like she was playing by the same rules as previous campaigns had. Because there is an active recall campaign, at least on the books, against her, this allowed the governor to raise or essentially completely avoid contribution limits and was able to take in enormous sums of money, contributions as high as $250,000, which really put her in unprecedented territory.
Yeah, this provision that she's going by, I believe, is more than 30 years old, in which the Secretary of State at the time said that candidates who are targeted by recall campaigns shouldn't be hamstrung. The logic being that if someone's trying to unseat you, you should be allowed to raise and spend as much as that recall campaign is. Craig, there are two groups that have filed in terms of their own campaigns to unseat Governor Whitmer. Are either of them raising any serious cash that you could see?
Yeah, no, it doesn't appear that they're raising serious cash. It doesn't appear that they're all that serious in themselves, really, from an outside perspective as well. I mean, this is really a straight up test of Michigan campaign finance law. We've had campaign contribution limits in this state for a long time to try to limit the influence of extremely large donors on office holders. This interpretation of the law, which there's probably going to be a fight over in the coming months and a very high stakes fight at that, is going to determine whether office holders going forward can take in these exorbitant donations if someone has simply filed a request to try to recall them. I mean, that's what's going on here. It's going to be a fascinating, fascinating thing to watch play out.
Wait a minute. So, Craig, you were tweeting today that this is a good question. I mean, would anything prevent an office holder from having someone who's a friend just launch that recall to have the ability to raise unlimited funds? I mean, Craig, do you think that that's a serious possibility?
I think it's more than a serious possibility. I think it could start in the next couple of days. I had a Republican tell me just a few hours ago that there might be a recall filed against Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky soon. I mean, this is something that is very likely to happen. I mean, in the world of political fundraising, all of these people are looking for any type of foothold or edge that they can achieve. And if this is one, if this is a tactic that's legal, other people are going to pursue it. Don't fool yourself on that.
Oh, man. Simon, what do you think? Do you see this as a real possible threat to transparency?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is something where there's a professional class of political consultants that exists, and erecting a nonprofit, creating a campaign, whether legitimate or phony, is something that they do day in and day out. And so as a result, they will easily take advantage of this provision. I think that this really speaks to a larger structural problem, though, in our campaign finance system, which is that the Michigan Campaign Finance Act is so vague on so many levels and has so many soft spots in it that it's left up to the Department of State only when prompted by someone asking a question or requesting a ruling to try to sort of establish rules that then are essentially, as Craig said, they cut corners as much as possible. And so because of this, we're really left up to lawyers and attorneys who are interested in sort of molding campaign finance rules in a way that would best suit their situations. I think that if this is allowed, if this approach is allowed to stand with the gubernatorial candidates, you're going to see a gubernatorial candidacy that can raise unlimited amounts of money without really even having to spend more than a token amount to defend itself against recall campaigns that so far haven't moved anywhere. And so I think that it really underscores what happens when we have such vague campaign finance rules.
Craig, you posted, you noted something interesting this morning that Governor Whitmer, way back when she was State Senator Whitmer, actually tried to curb campaign contribution allowances. But this amendment that she made to a campaign spending bill did not pass. The Senate at the time was, as it is now, led by Republicans. And now she's reaping the benefits of their own measure from 2013. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that is right. I mean, and that's something that Simon was talking about very intelligently there, that, you know, comparing the governor's current fundraising amount, which is extremely immense and impressive in terms of how much she's raised, to past governors is extremely tricky at this moment, because our campaign contribution limits doubled not that long ago in 2013. That's when she was in the state Senate. And now, on top of that fact, she's also raising unlimited amounts of money. So if Rick Snyder, when he was running for re-election in 2013, had the ability to take in unlimited donations from individuals in the state, he probably would have raised a lot more money than he did otherwise. I mean, there are people that will write very large checks to these individuals in power, and the contribution limit is what is basically preventing that from happening right now. The current limit is only $7,150 for an individual. Governor Whitmer is taking in donations of $250,000 or more from individuals. So this is a big difference.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that if those donations had been constrained to that the standard limit for a gubernatorial race, that it would have decreased her overall fundraising haul by about $2.7 million, which is more than a quarter of what she raised overall.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Simon Schuster. He is director of Michigan's Campaign Finance Network. We're also talking with Craig Mauger, reporter of the Detroit News. And we're just going over some of the campaign finance filings that became public yesterday. Governor Whitmer got some substantial gifts from out-of-state contributors. How much do you guys think that has to do with the profile that she has developed as an ally of Joe Biden, as someone nationally who's been sort of holding the line on coronavirus issues and other ways that the party has lifted her up as someone who's emblematic of what the party wants to represent today?
Well, you know, I think that there is an axiom that stands in politics, that all politics is local, right? But I think one caveat to that we're increasingly seeing is that when it comes to big dollar fundraisers, people who can contribute five and six figures to an effort, it's increasingly becoming less local. And this is especially true with the advent of digital fundraising. And this is something we're seeing across the board, from people, high-profile individuals like Governor Whitmer, to small-time candidates at the local level. But I think that when it really comes down to it, the governor has a high profile, and that allows her to sort of reach out and network with these individuals who are very high net worth, and then get them to sign an enormous check, which, again, wouldn't be possible without the recall campaigns that have been filed against her.
Yeah. We do have at least a couple of Republican contenders who have stepped forward. Former Detroit Police Chief James Craig, of course, has been making appearances on Fox News, indicating that he's going to run, although I understand he hasn't actually filed yet. Would you expect to see Craig out of state spending on a GOP candidate once somebody makes it through the primary?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this race for governor in Michigan is going to be a nationalized race in terms of, one, we are a battleground state. Everyone's going to be looking at what happens in Michigan in 2022 when they're prognosticating about 2024, the presidential election. And number two, Governor Whitmer is a rising star in Democratic politics. I mean, there are a lot of people that think, you know, she could potentially run for president one day. So I'm sure some of these donors are thinking, hey, I need to get in on the ground floor of this, start writing some large donations to Governor Whitmer. And maybe later, if she does continue to, you know, rise in politics, she'll remember me. I'll have this relationship with her. So, I mean, that's a portion of this. I mean, there's going to be a lot of attention on this race next year. And if there's a lot of national attention on the race, there's going to be a lot of national money flowing into it.
I see that Keith Rinke, a Republican who owns a successful chain of car dealerships, is thinking about running against Gretchen Whitmer and reportedly planning to put $10 million into his own campaign. Simon, does that automatically make him a contender by default?
That's a good question. And I think that there's a lot of things that are at play here in turning internal party politics, what will happen at nominating conventions, and the sort of support you can receive at the grassroots. But I think that that sort of speaks to where we're at in our politics right now, where these are increasingly sort of proxy fights, where it's less about what Michiganders care about and what's going on in this state and whether these candidates are speaking to issues relevant to them, but whether these candidates can reach out, touch on national issues that get people fired up, and then as a result, fundraise enormous amounts of money. Obviously, a way around this is, of course, to pour your own money into the race. But still, I think that it has less and less to do with connecting with voters when you reach these enormous sums of money, and increasingly more to do with whether or not you can blanket airwaves and social media with advertisements that get people fired up.
There's something that strikes me about the, you know, who's expressed interest in this race so far. And I'm trying to think about this not so much from a policy or a partisan standpoint as a money standpoint. The fact that we have several office holders who have not stepped forward and said that they're going to run for governor on the Republican side, does it say anything that the Republican Party and Republican money has not coalesced around a Republican who's already in office or who has been in office in Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it says something more about kind of the nature of the primary vote in the Republican Party right now. Republicans right now are really interested, to me it seems, the voters I talk to, in this idea of having an outsider come in and run. I mean, let's look at what Republicans have won Michigan of late. In 2016, it was Donald Trump, political outsider. In 2010 and 2014, it was Rick Snyder, this guy who's a businessman. When you talk to him, you don't think he's a politician. He really sounds differently. It seems like there's this recipe out there that we need to have a political insider, that is the Republicans' idea, have a political outsider run in this race. And what are we getting in potential candidates? We're getting James Craig, someone who's never run for office before, potentially Kevin Rinke, this businessman who hasn't run before. So that's what we're seeing play out in the race. And the money that Kevin Rinke potentially can bring into this will be a huge factor if it happens, because he'll be able to use that money to try to define these other individuals who are somewhat unknown as political quantities. So it's an X factor. I mean, I think what Kevin Rinke decides to do is a big X factor in this primary race.
Yeah. Hey, Simon, we haven't even really talked about some of the other legislative races. Was there anything important that you observed in yesterday's filings?
Right. I think that one thing that's really important to point out is that for all the growth in money in politics that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, despite all that, the contributions to state legislative candidates, or rather state legislators, is actually down from the same period in 2019. That said, what you see now is instead an increase in contributions to the caucus committees. Now, these are the committees that represent one party in each chamber of the legislature.
Meaning to say, I as a donor may be less excited in individual candidates as to giving to a party that I support and then letting them spend the money as they see fit?
Yes. But of course, in legislative races in Michigan for a long time, these races and the money in them is less defined by what individuals give and more about what political action committees and special interests give. Now, when you give to a candidate, you're severely limited to about $1,000 or $2,000, depending upon the chamber of the legislature. When you give to a caucus committee, you're able to give up to $40,000 or more. And as a result, these caucus committees can spend unlimited amounts on candidates in a general election. So you see, again, these races becoming less about the local issues in the districts and more about big game strategy, trying to take over these chambers and pour as much money into what they see as crucial districts as possible, regardless of whether or not, or the feelings of the voters in those districts.
Anything else I didn't ask about that you two noticed that you think is important to keep an eye on?
I mean, there's a lot of data here, and we're both, I'm sure, Simon is going to continue digging into it, and I'm sure there's going to be more pieces of news flagged in the coming days.
Well, guys, don't drown in your PDFs over the next couple of days. We really appreciate all the time that you're putting into these. We've been talking today with Simon Schuster, director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and with Craig Mauger, who used to have that job. He's now a reporter with the Detroit News. Simon, Craig, it's great talking to you. Thank you again.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up, at least one defendant in the alleged plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer says he was set up by government informants. How convincing is that argument?
You know, I think that to get a judge to say, I am dismissing this case because of entrapment, is very, very, very hard.
We'll talk with two BuzzFeed reporters who did a deep dive on FBI tactics in the case. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Federal prosecutors and attorneys for an armed anti-government militia continue this month to lay groundwork for a planned trial in October. The group of mostly Michigan men, the so-called Wolverine Watchmen, are accused of plotting last year to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The defense has indicated it will show jurors that the plot never would have happened had FBI informants not drawn militia members in. Two reporters with BuzzFeed have published a story that explores how confidential informants were used in the case and what these arguments may mean for similar investigations in the future. Jessica Garrison is a senior investigative editor for BuzzFeed News, based in San Francisco, and Ken Bensinger is an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed in LA. Ken, Jessica, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much, April.
Let's lay a little groundwork first. The FBI's investigations into domestic terrorism have gone through evolutions over the years. Of course, there was a time when investigators were looking into Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols' activities in Michigan, but the post-9/11 era had agents doing tons of work looking for domestic threats, almost entirely focused on suspects who are Muslims and suspects whose families had ties in Arab and African nations. What was the method over those years to, as prosecutors would put it, draw out latent threats to security?
I think that the playbook for these kind of things is relatively unchanged, regardless if it's Muslims or now right-wing extremists or in the past, left the weather underground or environmental activists on the left. Basically, the trick is to get someone inside the group, get that person in a trusted position, and then use that person as a lever to get more people in. Typically, what they do is they try to get in a confidential informant, someone who's not an FBI agent, someone who has a non-law enforcement background that people in the group can look up and see that they're, you know, not law enforcement or anything like that, and get those people in, develop that level of trust so that they can escort in undercover agents or other informants, et cetera, so that they can put eyes and ears on whatever the organization is up to.
Can you explain how many of the members of the group that was talking about this plot were working with the FBI?
So, no one that was charged, as far as we know, was an informant or an FBI agent. They separated those, right? So we know that one of the central figures in the case was a person known in court papers only as Dan, a guy from near Flint who joined the Watchmen, then became an FBI informant, and then sort of rose up within the Watchmen to become its second in command. We also know that a guy who wasn't in the Watchmen but who organized meetings that some of the Watchmen attended, and as well as field trainings in multiple locations in Michigan and outside of Michigan, we know that person is an FBI informant and has a long history of being an FBI a law enforcement informant. And we also know that, for example, on a very much notorious nighttime surveillance of Governor Whitmer's vacation home, at least two of the people on that trip were also undercover FBI agents. So on a trip that included about 12 people spread over three cars, there was, I think, four or five of the people on that one mission were basically working for the government.
You spend a fair amount of time in the story talking about and this one specific informant. In the court documents, he's referred to as CH2, or Dan, or the agents refer to him sometimes by the code name Thor. Can you tell us a little bit about him and how he got involved with the Watchmen?
So Dan is a really interesting character for a lot of reasons. Dan is a former U.S. Army soldier. He spent 68 days in Sadr City in Iraq. And then he got an honorable discharge and came home to Michigan. And he really believed that the fighting skills that he had acquired in the Army were sort of, as he put it, a perishable skill set. And he wanted to keep them up. And so in, you know, early 2020, he went on Facebook looking for a group he could train with. And Facebook's algorithm presented him with a group called the Wolverine Watchmen. And so Dan filled out a survey and said he was, you know, a libertarian and you know, believed in the Second Amendment. And the Watchmen then invited him, after a few more questions, to join their encrypted chat on an app called Wire. And once on that app, Dan was quite startled to see that there was conversation about, you know, possibly hurting or killing police officers, which is not at all what Dan was looking for, because Dan was looking basically to train. And so he went to his neighbor, a friend of his, who was a local law enforcement officer, and showed him the chat. And the friend put him in touch with the FBI. And at that point, you know, Dan had sort of thought, well, the FBI will handle this. But instead, the FBI said, we'd actually like you to go back into the group, but with us watching every step of the way. And so Dan agreed, and into the Wolverine Watchmen he went. And because he was a trained soldier, the Watchmen began to really look up to him, and he kind of helped them with their training. And before too long, Dan was the second in command of the group.
Yeah. His position of prominence kind of put him right at the center of the process that, I guess, became the plan. Can you talk about some kinds of things Dan did, you know, of his own volition that were his own idea, and things that his FBI handlers asked him to try to do?
Well, it's hard to know where the line between what Dan wanted to do and what the FBI wanted him to do is, where we can draw that line, because the evidence shows that in many instances they were sitting together sort of thinking with one mind about how to move the case forward. What we have seen, for example, are text messages from the FBI telling Dan to invite specific people on a reconnaissance mission during the daytime of Governor Whitmer's house, and the FBI agent specifically named three or four individuals that they wanted him to invite, and there was a back and forth about which of those could go and whether there was room in his vehicle. We also have access to an audio recording of Dan making a phone call to one of the probably the most prominent defendants in the federal case, a man named Adam Fox. We see this as a call that Dan initiated sitting in the FBI office in Flint with two FBI agents as he made this call, and not only gave Fox an opportunity to sort of rant about the governor, but also specifically invited him to train with them. That stuck out to us because Dan, when he went to the FBI, was worried about people doing violent actions. Here he is on a phone call with a guy who is spouting off pretty horrifyingly violent notions about what he'd like to do to the governor, including hog-tying her and putting her on a table for public display. But instead of sort of trying to shut that down, what Dan does is say, hey, you should come hang out with us. You should train with us more. So we see those. We also have known from our reporting that Dan went to great lengths to make it easy for everyone to participate in all these key events that the government later pointed to as signal events in the case. So Dan at one point rented a Suburban, paid for fuel, paid for lodging for some people, and paid for snacks for people to travel to Wisconsin for a training that was seen as an important sort of national meetup of militia groups. We've seen Dan sort of driving relentlessly to pick people up. He seemed to have infinite amounts of time to drive people from here to there to provide them with, you know, transportation, food, lodging, and other help. It's been alleged he even paid for someone else's truck to get repaired. So all these things that he was reimbursed for by the FBI that made it easier for these people to participate in what the government would later call a conspiracy.
We should say Dan was paid, $26,000. For his work and received a car from the FBI, correct?
He was paid $24,000, but then there was an additional $30,000 in expenses, which included a new vehicle. They paid his mortgage for a while. They paid his, I think, his phone bill. they bought him a new computer and a new phone. And I spotted in a document recently that they also even paid his, he sold his house for security concerns after the case went public. And he claims he sort of lost on that or didn't make as much as he would have expected to. And so the FBI paid him $4,500 to make up for that.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Ken Bensinger and Jessica Garrison, who worked on an investigative piece for BuzzFeed News about the so-called Wolverine Watchmen and the activities of confidential informants interacting with the alleged conspirators. Ken, Jessica, I wanted to just ask you a little bit about the concept of entrapment. And the defense has indicated this is something that they want to pursue, assuming this all goes to trial. How effective have entrapment claims been as a defense strategy for people the government accuses of domestic terrorism?
I mean, in a word, not very. I think that to get a judge to say, I am dismissing this case because of entrapment is very, very, very hard. That said, you can, and the rules are a little different in Michigan state court and in federal court, but you can, present, argue to the jury that you've been entrapped. And that really depends on what the jury is going to do. And juries are notoriously difficult to predict in many cases. And then I think there's also, in the court system, the opportunity to like plea things down. And I have no idea whether that will happen in this case, but I think sometimes you see that happening where people will plea to lesser charges after arguing entrapment.
There is indeed a huge pile of evidence of text messages and phone calls and video of members of the group saying and doing anti-government things. If the defense is saying that this group of men was set up by the FBI and undercover informants, what are they saying about the defendant's actual motivations?
So they're saying that these were people who were disgruntled with the government and unhappy and had political beliefs that were critical of the government. But they also say that those people, they acknowledge that, but they also say that those were all thoughts that are protected by the First Amendment, that in this country it's not illegal to not like your government or not like your elected official, or even, they argue, to make vague sort of violent thoughts about the government or people in it. They claim essentially that unless you're making a specific plan for a specific action that presents an imminent threat to an elected official, it's really just talk. It's really just fantasy and doesn't represent anything that would be close to what the government is calling a conspiracy. So the defense, we discussed entrapment, but the other sort of pillar of their defense is going to be that this is truly a First Amendment protected behavior, and that it's okay to believe what you want to believe, and that we live in a republic where people are allowed to have their beliefs without fear of persecution.
So the thinking among federal investigators and prosecutors is that if you know someone has a strong anti-government belief system, and if you see that they have a propensity toward violence and you don't intervene and find out how far they're willing to go, you risk them being contacted and maybe activated by somebody who might help them act on those feelings in a true conspiracy. Have you run across anything in the court filings that runs through that line of conversation among the FBI handlers and the informants who were working on the case?
Specifically, one of the FBI agents in this case discussed this in a hearing, and he said that they're trained and that their rules are that they're not allowed to target people for their beliefs, no matter how extreme they are. So that's the party line. I guess the question we have to contemplate is whether there's a chance that maybe they ignored that mandate and ultimately did think about people for their beliefs. And how you can sort of divide the moment between, appropriate preemptive action and sort of thought police, where the FBI can do that and how well it can navigate that. I think in some ways that's really going to be one of the things at trial in this case.
Do you think that this approach is problematic in any way for people who might be sympathetic to some of the arguments on the right about government overreach and who already think the government is overreaching and may look at this case and say, yeah, these guys were set up?
I mean, I think that's what's so interesting about this case in this moment, that we are at a moment in our society and in our culture where, you know, in many arenas, there is a lot of disagreement about sort of how we perceive reality and what's happening. And I think how this case is perceived is another example of that, right? There are people who perceive this case as the government, you know, averting a terrible plot and keeping, you know, the world and the country safe from domestic extremism. And then there are people who perceive this case as like an absolute witch hunt. And I think that's just yet another reason, frankly, that it's so interesting, because there's not a lot of overlap between those two views.
It may be that a person doesn't have to originate a crime to be convicted of plotting to carry it out. But at the same time, it feels like this has been a frightening moment for a lot of Michiganders. As it's been reported, a number of the watchmen were at the Capitol rally on April 30th, 2020, when many anti-government forces stormed the Capitol, and I think just a lot of people weren't quite aware of how far anti-government groups might have been willing to go. Did you get any sense by looking over the pretrial findings and what has been filed of whether these defendants were prepared to do something had Thor/Dan not talked to them about doing it?
Ah, it's interesting. Yeah, even on that day you mentioned, April 30th, 2020, there was talk in the group about storming the Capitol. In the end, Michigan State Police let people in without resistance, but it was for many people eerily reminiscent or sort of foreshadowing of what would happen in January in Washington D.C. at the U.S. Capitol. In Michigan, they let them in, but there was a thought that if they hadn't, there would have been violence. And unlike Washington, these people all had loaded rifles and pistols on their person. The watchmen certainly talked a big game about committing acts of violence. One member, a guy named Pete Musico, showed his friends, a fellow watchman, a cylinder of something he claimed was C4 plastic explosives. He claimed he'd thrown a Molotov cocktail in the house of a policeman who'd given him a ticket. Others had talked about other sort of violent acts they alleged they had done. One of them, late in the case, appeared to be soliciting a murder for hire of an ex-policeman in Maine who he said was a bad person and needed to be bumped off. There was a lot of this kind of talk among these people. But it turns out that plastic explosive shown by that one watchman was a fake, and there's no evidence that he ever threw a Molotov cocktail anywhere. Likewise, for the guy who wanted to murder a cop, no one ever took him up on the opportunity. So we see a lot of people talking a very big game about wanting to be violent. It's not clear that any of them ever really did, though.
Have either of you had any sense of what this case might mean for the Justice Department's path going forward, and whether the FBI and the DOJ will carry forward the techniques that were developed during the Bush and Obama administrations to investigate domestic threats?
I mean, I think this is a big case just by virtue of the fact that there are a lot of defendants. It's very high profile. There were a lot of FBI agents on this. You know, there's hours and hours and hours of wiretap. So I think in that sense, it's a very big case. I think that, you know, as President Biden has talked about combating domestic terror, he and his attorney general have gone out of their way to stress that they are interested in violent actions, not, as think as they put it, you know, hateful ideology. And they have really stressed that they intend to protect people's constitutional rights. And I think, you know, what this case and the sort of reaction to this case illustrates is that's a very fine line to walk.
Jessica Garrison is a senior investigative editor for BuzzFeed in San Francisco. We've also been talking with Ken Bensinger, an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News out of Los Angeles. Jessica, Ken, thank you so much for the story and for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that's today's edition of Stateside. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.